You know, often people visit us looking for a church. When I talk to them, a lot of times they'll say that. Why are you here? What brought you here today? I'm looking for a church. Nothing wrong with that. A question I might ask, though, is what criteria serves to provide for you the standard of what kind of church you're going to choose? What kind of church are you looking for? Here's some standard things. It may not be visitors today or visitors in this area necessarily, but this is pretty standard here, what people do say. People are looking for people like themselves. People look for people in the same age group as themselves, maybe the same race, the same culture, same gender, so on. First thing that a person thinks about when he enters a room full of strangers is, who looks like I do? This is very typical. You do this as well. I do this as well. Look for people like myself. Everyone does that. People also look for others with the same demographic. Single people gravitate to single people. Married people with young kids gravitate to married people with young kids. And older couples gravitate to older couples. There's an old saying that says, birds of a feather flock together. And I think it's quite true in this context. People want a nice, friendly group. They want a nice, warm reception. Nothing wrong with that. They want a group that does not ask uncomfortable questions, doesn't push for a commitment, that just simply accepts that person as they are, treats that person like a welcome guest and not a mere visitor, not a number, giving them that obligatory handshake there. They want something more than that. A lot of people want a charismatic preacher, someone who makes you feel welcome and special, someone maybe who's fun and witty and clever with words, doesn't intimidate anyone or make any demands, offers an uplifting message filled with, hopefully, heartwarming anecdotes and stories. People want a group that is of a good size. They don't want it too big because that makes it impersonal. But they don't want it too small either because then it makes it hard to hide, if you know what I'm saying. Okay? And it appears to some people, a small group appears that it's dying. They want a group that is just right in its size. People want an enjoyable worship service, one that's designed to lift me up and make me feel better about myself. Don't want a worship service that's too long, too hard to understand, too heavy with doctrine and theology. Just really want a nice, comfortable, relaxing, even entertaining worship service. Preferably, a lot of people think, with a well-trained choir and maybe a band, since that seems to heighten the spirituality of the experience. People are looking for lots of activities and programs in churches because many people think churches ought to double as a community center, offering social services, singles groups, daycare facilities, youth ministries, and even sports teams. And this is a big one, paying special attention to my children. I have had people here tell me, straight up, when I ask them, why are you here? Well, we're here because of our kids. If our kids like this church, then we'll stay. If they don't, then we'll go. I've had them say that almost verbatim. Churches are expected to spend a great deal of time and money and attention to children, to the extent, in some cases, that it matters little else what we preach or what else we do, as long as we take care of the children. These are some of the standard criteria that people have for choosing a church. Maybe it's not yours if you're here visiting this morning. I'm not trying to impose that upon you and say this is why you're here. But this is pretty typical. If you were to look across the nation and poll people, this has already been done. This is what people are looking for. The question is, if Jesus were looking for a church, and as Jesus looks at churches, what is his criteria? What kind of church is he looking for? What kind of church does he approve of? Would it be the same as mine and yours, the criteria that is? Would Jesus choose to be here in this church? If Jesus were in town, so to speak, would he choose to worship with us? And if so, why would he choose that? And if he wouldn't, then why wouldn't he choose us? It may surprise us all. What is important to us with regard to what a church offers may not be the same thing that Jesus chooses. And vice versa, what is important to Jesus may not be the exact same thing that is important to us. So here's a subject that is worthy of our attention. In order to be a church that Jesus approves of, you have to know what it is that he looks for. You cannot accidentally stumble into approval. If we are not that church, I should emphasize that differently. If we here are not that church, then we need to discover what we're doing wrong and correct that with a sense of urgency. Sadly, and you know this already, society has trained us all to be a very me-centered person and to look for short-term, even instant gratification. We want to be personally fulfilled, and we want to be personally fulfilled like right now, okay? Not later on, not in a week or a month. We want that right now. People want to leave worship services and churches just feeling like they're on cloud nine, completely infused with all kinds of spirituality, just feeling jacked up for the week and, you know, like, wow, this was such a powerful, emotive experience. So all that spills into religion, as you can imagine. You know, we get a lot of visitors here, but usually we have one chance to make one good, lasting impression. For many people, once they find out that we do not have a band, we do not have a separate youth ministry, we do not have a program to pay their utility bills, or we do not have a latte stand in our foyer, they're gone. Never mind what we do offer. Never mind what we do have. We don't have what they were looking for. In my office, I have a drawer full of visitor cards that I have been collecting over the last, 10-plus years that I've been here. And a lot of those people never came back. Most of those people never came back. They had one shot, or I should say, we had one shot, okay? They gave us one shot to make a good impression on them. And either we failed in that, which I'm willing to concede that may have been the case, or they were looking for something completely different than what we had to offer, and they never came back. And it's hard, honestly, to compete with churches today who use entertainment as worship, who emphasize creature comforts over holy living, who preach soft and fluffy messages as opposed to the gospel message that deals with sin and offers salvation and teaches discipleship. It's very hard to compete with that, and I understand that, and you should understand that too. And I'm not suggesting throughout this whole lesson that we here at Kent are better than all other churches or that we are free from problems. I don't think that we are. But I am saying that the New Testament pattern does not lead us in a direction that so many churches have gone. My observation has been this, for what it's worth, that churches often are more interested in numbers, two in particular, attendance and revenue, than they are in preaching the gospel of Christ and worshiping in spirit and truth. It doesn't matter what they say. Those are the two numbers that they're looking for. Let me illustrate this in a different way. A lot of you are familiar with the Old Testament in the case of King Saul and how disappointing he was as the first king of Israel. And so God sends Samuel, the prophet, to the house of Jesse to anoint one of his sons. And seven of his sons are tall, fine-looking, strapping men. And Samuel is pretty impressed with those people. But God is looking for something far different than all that. And it says there that the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance, that of Eliab, the oldest, or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God does not see, sees not, as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." None of those sons were fit as far as the Lord was concerned. That's how David got in the picture. He was the eighth son who was out in the field tending sheep at the time of this visit of Samuel's. So I want to apply that principle that we just saw here to churches. As man sees churches, many of the so-called mainstream, contemporary, progressive churches seem to have a lot going for them. They have a huge attendance. They have exciting services. They have youth rallies. They have Bible camps. They have a large staff of preachers and counselors and church growers. They have a band. They have singers. They have a lot of stuff going on throughout the week. That's what man sees. And that's what looks like a really exciting family church that we would want to go to. As man sees that, that is very appealing. Namely, because it satisfies man's version of a so-called Christian church. Not necessarily God's pattern for one. It caters to modern desires, not a doctrinal blueprint. Just lost a bunch of people right there. I used the word doctrine. Sorry. Because when we start talking about doctrine, then we start talking about stuff that seemingly divides people. And we want to bring everyone together, so we kind of need to, you know, push doctrine aside and emphasize love and fellowship and faith and all that good stuff, that gushy stuff that people just love to fill themselves up with. So God gave us this pattern, and a lot of people are just kind of shrugging at it. God didn't give us a pattern so we could shrug at it and say to him, we've got our own plan, our own pattern, and quite frankly, God, you will like it. Okay, and so that's what people are doing today. And I'm not saying this like in a facetious way. I'm saying this is actually happening, where people are just ignoring the pattern and coming up with a different pattern and then telling God that he will like it. And if every church followed the same pattern, think about it. If every church followed the same pattern, we would all have the same mission. We'd all be having a focus on discipleship. We'd all have the same message. It would be the New Testament gospel. We would all have the same method of salvation, not multiple methods like we do today. We would all have the same church organization. We would all be constructed the same way, so to speak. I'm not talking about the building. I'm talking about our church government, if you will, our organization in that respect. Just like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4:17, he says to the Corinthians, I've sent Timothy, my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. He will remind you of my ways which are in Christ, just as I teach everywhere in every church. One plan, one pattern, one message, one gospel for every church. What a phenomenal idea. Not something that we are following today, by the way, in the so-called religious community, but it's something that was originally intended and should be how it is still. In Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3, Jesus dictated letters to seven churches who were in the Roman province of Asia Minor. Those churches are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. These are all relatively close together geographically, but they are radically different with regard to their character and, if I can put it this way, their work ethic. It has been said, and I think it is true, that every church that claims to be of Christ is represented by one of those seven churches. And that means our congregation, by the way. As we go through this lesson, I want you to be thinking about our congregation, those of you who are members here in particular. I want you to be thinking, which of those churches does Kent most closely identify with? And be honest, be fair, okay? And just kind of look at all the details of those churches to the extent that we're going to go through, which is very surface for the time we have involved. Remember the opening list of what people look for in a church. It might surprise us what Jesus was looking for when he wrote to these seven churches. First thing he wanted was sound teaching. The sound teaching of Jesus Christ himself and of the apostles that he commissioned to give the church instruction in the first place. And some of these churches did well, such as Ephesus and Philadelphia. Others tolerated false teaching among them, Pergamum, Thyatira in particular. Many people today, as I said, think that doctrine is expendable as long as we love everyone and tolerate everything. Well, that's just not how Jesus saw things. He saw sound doctrine, sound teaching, as something very important. Jesus actually praised churches that confronted and removed those who would not honor sound teaching. To those who were careless and adopting false doctrine, he would say, "This I have against you," which is another way of saying, you're in sin and you need to take care of that. Repent of that. This is a problem and it needs to be addressed. That's a serious charge when he says, "This I have against you." He's not saying, "Well, you and I are in disagreement on this one point." That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, I know what is true. I am the standard of truth. You are doing something different than that, and you are in serious moral error here, and I'm going to come against you in judgment if you don't deal with that problem. He threatened them with judgment. This is very similar to what Paul said, though, in 1 Timothy 6, verse 3 and 4. He says, if anyone advocates a different doctrine and does not agree with sound words, those of our Lord Jesus Christ, and with the doctrine conforming to godliness, he says, that person is conceited and understands nothing. No matter what they think of themselves, no matter what you might think of them, this is what Paul's evaluation of that person is. He has shown himself to be not understanding of the concept of doctrine and looking inward rather than outward, okay, as far as himself. He's conceited. He's just only thinking of himself. What Christ says must be what we teach, must be what we preach, must be what we defend, regardless of whether or not it is popular or increases revenue or appeals to visitors. We're not here for those things, I hope. Is this something important to us? Is sound teaching something that is important to this congregation? Is it something important to you as a member here? Is it something important to you as a visitor here? Because it's certainly important to Jesus Christ. Jesus also looked for people with right hearts, sincere hearts, faithful hearts, people with an uncorrupted love, as opposed to serving themselves and just looking for numbers. Here we have the church in Ephesus in chapter 2 that was read for us. Here's a church that is busy and active, but he accuses them, and rightly so. He says, you've left your first love, which is another way of saying you forgot your first priority. I think we could paraphrase it in this way, in our own modern vernacular. You got so busy doing the church stuff that you forgot about why you're doing the church stuff, is really what it comes down to. You forgot that love for me has to be the first reason for why you come together in the first place. This is not, then, a love for church going or a love for sermons or a love for singing, but it has to be a love for Christ, a love for God, which we're told in Matthew 22, verse 37 through 39, Jesus tells us that you have to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And if you can't do those things or won't do those things, then nothing else is really going to matter. So imagine you have a church that's all busy doing church stuff and it all looks good on the surface, but there's this gaping hole in the middle of it all where love for Christ ought to be, or it's been misplaced or filled up with something else instead. Jesus does not take kindly to that. In fact, it is not something that he will condone. We're not saying just do whatever you want as long as you love Jesus. That would be the wrong approach here. But rather, we are saying this. Whatever Jesus asks you to do, do it because you love him. And not for any other reason or especially any lesser reason. This has to be the basis for, the foundation of our relationship with Christ. Remember what he said in John 14, 15. We quote this a lot. Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. Okay? So there's an if-then conditional statement. Your love for me, rather, is made evident or manifested through your willingness to follow my commandments that I give you. If a person's heart is not right with God, or in the case of a congregation, if the whole congregation's heart is not right with God, so to speak, it doesn't matter how great a church that we appear to be. But if our hearts are right, then we're going to show this by putting him ahead of us, his will ahead of our will, even to our own hurt, even at a sacrifice to ourselves. Is this important to this group? Is this important to you as a church member of this group? If you're looking here for a church you've come here looking for a church to be a part of, is this important to you as well? Do you want a church that has Jesus as the center of its existence, that serves Jesus with a humble and loving heart? Or do you just want a group that makes you feel pumped up and energized, makes you feel better about yourself or for your kids and family? What are you looking for? These are good questions we should be asking ourselves. Jesus also looked for a church that was zealous for him, zealous for his work. eagerly desiring fellowship with him, anxious to follow him, willing to sacrifice for him. We have other passages we could cite in reference to this. Romans 12, verse 11, where Paul says that we ought not to be lagging behind in diligence, but be fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. 1 Peter 1:22, since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, well then, fervently love one another from the heart. And then Titus 2:14, Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deeds, to purify for himself a people of his own possession, zealous for good deeds. These words here, like diligence and fervent and zealous, these all mean something. They mean, fervent literally means hot or boiling, and there's an implication of strong eagerness, a strong desire, not a passive shoulder-shrugging resignation, like, fine, if I have to do this, then we'll do it. But rather a desire that just puts everything else off the table and says, no, we're going to do this because it's important, because it's of God. This is what we're going to do. We're going to resolve to do this because it's the right thing. Laodicea, for example, in chapter 3 of Revelation, was a church that was self-sufficient, very self-resourceful. They did not depend upon Christ. They depended upon themselves. And Jesus says that you're neither hot, zealous, or even cold, lifeless, but you're kind of trying to be something in between, which he labels as lukewarm, or we could say tepid, or just simply indifferent. Indifference is a horrible thing to Jesus. He says, because you're indifferent, because you're lukewarm, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. The Greek word is more graphic. It says, I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. That's literally what he's saying. So Jesus would rather you be on fire, or he'd rather you just bail altogether. But this lukewarmness, this being in the middle and being kind of tepid and being indifferent, like, yeah, this doesn't really matter one way or the other, that's the worst thing of all. That's the worst thing a church can be. He would rather us fold up shop rather than be that, is what he is saying there. So how does all this describe us? How would Jesus describe us? How would Jesus describe you personally? And if you're a person here this morning looking for a church, is zeal for Christ important to you? I'm going to give you this. It probably is. But my question is, and here is the important question, are you yourself a zealous believer, or do you just want us to be so that you can be with us by association? Where do you stand? Church that's doing God's work is also very important to Jesus. Not just doing busyness, not just busy, because lots of churches are busy, but busy doing the right things and doing those right things for the right reason, for the right cause. And some churches are doing well, like Ephesus and Smyrna and Philadelphia. Others were failing or have failed, notably Sardis, which was basically asleep at the wheel there. And then Laodicea, as I mentioned, which was indifferent. As I said, many churches are busy with all kinds of church activities. But when Jesus talks about deeds and work and toil, he implies what the early church did and what they were taught to do as well, what they were instructed to do by the apostles. Not food drives and soup kitchens and Christmas dramas and music shows and vacation Bible schools and all these other things that churches devote so much time and attention to. But rather, preaching the gospel, studying the word of God, serving the saints, praying for one another, showing hospitality, those are the things that we're actually told to do in the New Testament. Those are the specific instructions we're given as churches to complete and fulfill in the New Testament. These other things that came after the fact, and we think it's all a good work because God's involved. Well, we made God involved because we dragged his name into it, but that doesn't mean it's a good work by itself. That's not what makes good works. It's God that defines what is good, and we either accept that or we don't. Our mission, our reason for existence, all is summed up in discipleship to Christ, not keeping people comfortable and entertained, not taking care of, you know, the families in the sense of making sure that everyone's got a place where they feel, like a part of a great community. If you're a Christian doing the work of Christ and in that Christian context, you're going to feel a part of a community right there. In other words, it's not so much what we are going to do for you, it's what we are all doing for one another in the right cause or for the right reason there. Is that important to us? Is that important to us here at Kent? Is that important to you as a member of this congregation? What appeals to you? If you're a person looking for a church, what are you looking for? Are you looking for a church that is doing God's work, or do you just want a church that is going to fulfill your expectations? Because those are not necessarily the same things. And here, this last one. This is a hard sell. It always is, especially today. When everyone wants to be comfortable and pampered, Jesus looks for a church that is willing to suffer for what is right. Read with me in chapter 2, Revelation chapter 2, verse 3. He says to the church at Ephesus, "You have perseverance and have endured for my name's sake and have not grown weary." Well, what is that perseverance and endurance all about? Well, the implication here is that you are in the midst of a lot of trouble and that you are dealing with a lot of difficulty, and yet you are persevering. That word persevere literally comes from a word, a compound word, which means through a severe situation. So you have gone through a severe situation, and yet you have endured that faith of yours in that situation. You've left your first love, unfortunately, but you at least have shown that you are capable of enduring in difficult times. Chapter 2 and verse 9 and 10, the first part of verse 10, chapter 2, verse 9, "I know your tribulation," the church at Smyrna, he says, "I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. That's some pretty heady stuff there, isn't it? And he talks about how in the church in Pergamum, in verse 13, that's where Satan dwells there. And some of those people have been killed among them. And all these different churches going through a real difficult scenario. The seven churches, all seven churches, were in a center of a culture that honored Roman emperors as divine beings or divine persons, as gods. And those who refused to honor those emperors in that way faced seizure by the empire, seizure of their property, seizure of their businesses, seizure of sometimes their family, or they were sent into exile, or they were sent into prison, or they were sent to hard labor camps, or they were executed. This is not a passive, indifferent opportunity. This is an opportunity to either be counted or to bail altogether. There is no middle of the road. You either belong or you don't belong. This is where we separate the men from the boys, really where we separate the Christians from the churchgoers. So what he's saying here is that there's some difficulties that you're facing. The early Christians suffered dearly for standing up for Jesus and suffered dearly for standing up for the word. And Jesus not only praised them for that, but he expected it from them. To the church at Smyrna, he never apologized. He says, "Hey, I'm really sorry. This was an oversight. The Lord and I, God and I, did not see this coming. But you're going to have to go. I'm sorry about it. You're going to have to go through some suffering. I hope you can make it. Hopefully this won't happen again." You don't see any of that kind of nonsense. Jesus is saying, you are going to go through some suffering. I'm not going to apologize for it because I didn't do anything wrong. And in allowing you to be confronted with that, well, it's kind of a backward compliment. He's saying, you can take this. And he says, really, what I'm looking for is that you be faithful until death. Not that you're going to die, but you be faithful regardless until you die. And today, many are preaching soft and neutered messages, not only because it tickles the ears, but because, of all things, they don't want to offend sinners. Can you imagine that? We need to preach a gospel that doesn't offend sinners. I mean, this is what churches have come to today. Rather than have controversy and upsetting people, we need to, we need to water down the message. And what we really need to do is just boldly speak what is true. I don't mean tactlessly or without compassion. We need to speak the truth in love, just like Ephesians 4:15 says, speaking the truth in love. But love doesn't mean that we water it down and make it all soft and cotton candy. Love simply means that we're doing what is in the best interest of the other person. We need to speak the truth with that, in the best interest of that other person. Sometimes we can sit down and reason with one another, and it'll be a good experience. Other times we need to be a little harder. Sometimes we need to confront people and say, no, friend, you are wrong. Here is the truth. This is what it says, and you are doing something completely the opposite. And that's going to take its toll on us. There's going to be a repercussion to that. There's going to be often a retaliation to that. There's going to be a suffering that comes along with that when we take that position. I guess what I'm saying right now is, are we willing to do that? Are we doing that now here at this congregation? Are we willing to say whatever needs to be said and do whatever needs to be done in service to the Master? Or are we going to buckle and bend at the slightest hint of suffering? Like we're going to put our personal comfort and our self-protection ahead of our discipleship to Christ. What are we going to do? And if you're looking for a congregation, a church to be a part of, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the truth? Or are you looking for a bunch of people who are going to so water down what is true that it's no longer truth at all, but it does make people feel good? What are you really looking for? Are you offended by God's truth, or is it God's truth that you came here to seek in the first place, which I really hope that it is? What is conspicuously missing from Jesus' evaluation of these seven churches? Well, first of all, there is conspicuously missing from all that is human approval or popular approval. The character of the congregations are not measured in whether they met your or my expectations, but rather whether they met His. And since churches are founded in His name, either literally or ideally, then He has every right to hold us accountable for who we are and what we do. Hold us accountable to His standard, rather, not to ours, and certainly not to public opinion. I notice here, as you should, that demographics doesn't seem to be a big concern for Jesus. I know that it is often for us. Age groups, marital status, number of children, what race, ethnicity, cultural factors, none of that seems to matter whatsoever. I'm not saying it doesn't matter to us at all. I'm saying in the big picture, however, we can get together and do whatever we need to do in whatever age group we are or whether any status that we are or whatever race we are. It doesn't really matter so long as we have a standard and we have the same love for the same Lord. So why should it matter so much to us? In other words, what should matter to us is, are we faithful Christians or aren't we? That's what should matter to us. There's nothing said about the preacher, whether he's fun and witty and clever with words, or whether he offers powerful, uplifting messages every lesson, or whether he fulfills everyone's expectations for a preacher. I'm not saying that preachers are not important, because I think that they are, but they're certainly not all important. They're not the ringmaster. They're not the master of ceremonies, and they're not necessarily the best Christians in the group. They're not the center of attention. If they were, then I think Jesus would have mentioned some of the preachers in the midst of all this. There's nothing said about the size of the congregation. Nothing said about the worship services. The emphases are all on the genuineness, the zeal, the work ethic, and the servitude of those Christians involved in those groups. Those work ethics and zeal and genuineness as defined by and a direct implementation of apostolic instruction. In other words, not just saying, hey, we're a zealous group of people, we just don't do what God says, but we're still zealous. No, it's not like that. Our zeal is based on what we've been taught. Our work ethic is based on what we've been taught. Our work itself is based on what we've been taught to do, not what we came up with and then handed up to God and say, you will like this. We attached your name to it after all, like so many churches do today. I notice that Jesus did not require His churches to provide social services or charity work for communities. He did require that they do what no one else has a right to do. Think about this. Any group can get out there and take care of the hungry and the homeless. Any group can volunteer for a soup kitchen, or any group can volunteer at a charity organization, or you know, have a garage sale or fireworks stand. Anyone can do that. What we should be busy doing is what no other group has the right to do, and that is to preach the gospel of Christ. That's our work. What we should do is exemplify that gospel in our own personal and collective behavior as Christians who not only preach the message, but embody that message in our personal and private lives. That's what we have the right to do. No one else has the right to do that. No one else has the right to go saving souls by a message that they came up with or their church came up with. No one else has the right to persevere through difficulties that they created for themselves. Rather, we should persevere through difficulties that come upon us only because we hold to something that no one else will do. Nowhere else in the New Testament does he lay responsibility for children upon the churches. There is no children's church in the New Testament. There is no staff daycares in the New Testament. There is no youth ministries in the New Testament. There are no children's classes that compromise or interfere with the mission of discipleship in the New Testament. If you're thinking that I'm being hard on children, I'm not. I'm trying to say that the church's obligation is not to children. That lies on the parents. But the church's obligation is to preach a gospel that really is targeted at adults and adult responsibility. Now, we do offer children's classes here. We do so expediently, okay, as an expedient, something that is expendable if necessary, not something that is going to happen even at the expense of all other things. A lot of churches have this upside down. It's the children first and then the adults. What we need to recognize is the adults first and then the children. If that sounds offensive to you, I would challenge you to go into your New Testament and prove it otherwise. I'm not saying that in a confrontational way. I'm saying that as a come, let us reason together. What does the New Testament teach? Are we people that hold to the New Testament or aren't we? Do I care about children? Of course I do. I've got two kids myself, and they went through the system, so to speak. They sat through a lot of sermons and went to a lot of classes and so on. But the objective was not to cater to them being children. The objective was to provide for them an example and a teaching for them so that when they grew up, they would choose Christ, just as we would hope anyone would choose Christ. What people often look for is a church that caters to people's desires. We've been conditioned to do this. We've been trained by society to do this. But if we are going to be a church that is truly of Christ, not just in name, but in service and in the cause that we serve and in the one that we serve, we need to honor Christ. We're not here to honor you. We're not here to honor me. We're not here to honor us. We're not here to honor people or people's kids or people's families. We're not here to honor anything less than who we're here to collectively to assemble before, and that is Jesus Christ himself. Even if it costs us something, even if it's to our own hurt, even if it costs us revenue and numbers and popularity, and it will, by the way, we don't exist for those things. You and I should not be expecting us to exist for those things. And thus, this must be far more important to us and hopefully to our guests. I'm just going to give this to you, that our guests are here because they love Christ and they want to draw closer to him, or they want to learn more about him at least. What Jesus looks for in a church is more important than what we should look for. Our mission must be to serve the Master, not serve ourselves. And that begs the question, what would Jesus say about this congregation? If he were to write a letter to us or write a letter about us, what would he say about us? Are we a church that is of Christ? Are we a church that Christ is looking for? If Jesus were in the area, as I said earlier, would he choose to worship here? Or would he look at us and say, that place has got some problems? And they're not willing to address them. And until they do address them, I can't have fellowship with them. Which of the seven churches best describes where Kent is right now? Is it Ephesus that left their first love? Is it Pergamum or Thyatira that allowed false teaching and corruption to destroy their integrity? Is it Sardis that had a name that they were alive, But Jesus says, but you're dead, need to shape up or disappear. Is it Laodicea that thought they were so self-resourceful and Jesus says, your indifference makes me sick to my stomach? You're so self-absorbed that it just makes me nauseous. I want to spit you out of my mouth. Or are we like Smyrna or Philadelphia, the only two churches in which nothing bad is said? Which church best describes us? Remember, like God with Samuel, Jesus does not look at outward appearances alone. He does not see as man sees. Frankly, he doesn't care what man sees or that people disagree with him. In Luke chapter 16, verse 15, he told the Pharisees, that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. So which is it? Who are we trying to please? Who are we trying to follow? Even if we have a name that we are alive, it doesn't mean that we are. It doesn't mean that we have met his approval. Our fellowship with Christ is not dependent upon what we think. It's dependent upon what he knows to be true. So I want you tonight to think about that. And if we are not that church that Jesus is looking for, we have work to do. Notice the pronoun there, we. Not our elders or the preacher or the older members and the people, only the people that take that serious, but we who are members here, all of us. The Kent Church of Christ is not limited to a handful of people, but is refers to everyone who has made a commitment as a member of this congregation. So if we have a problem, then we have work to do to resolve that problem, to come back into conformity with the standard. Jesus told the church at Smyrna, after telling them that they're going to suffer and be persecuted, he says, be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. That's a pretty big promise. You see, Jesus wants faithful followers, and he wants faithful churches. Not our version of faithful, or yours, but those dedicated to serving him, and serving his word, and serving his cause, and serving his people. In the end, he says, I will honor you if that's the kind of people you choose to be. If you put me first, then in the end, when I put that crown of life on your head, so to speak, then I will honor you like you could never have been honored here on earth. I hope that's important to us. I hope that's important to you as a member. And if you're visiting with us, I hope that's important to you as well. What does Jesus look for in a church? What kind of church are we? It's not my place to sit here and evaluate Kent for all the rest of us. Is our place to all of us look to ourselves and look to this group and determine where do we stand exactly. That's our lesson for this morning. If you are inspired by that gospel message to serve Christ, to honor him, to be a disciple of his for life, even to your own hurt, because of the reward and the promise that you have to look forward to and because he is worth your honor and your service, you might want to become a Christian then. You may have been thinking about that, and it is time to do something about that. If you're ready to be baptized this morning, or if you have other spiritual need we can help you with, this will be your time to come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song Bob has selected for us.